This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite platform, and rate and review us while you're there. Reason is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, and I'm talking to all the living editors-in-chief to take the measure of the world's only magazine of free minds and free markets in its first half century. I've talked with Bob Poole, Virginia Postrel, Matt Welch, and Catherine Mangu Ward, and today I'm honored to speak with Marty Zupan, who edited Reason from 1984 to 1989 before moving on to become the head of the Institute for Humane Studies. Marty, thanks for talking.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So, you know, as we look back at the first 50 years of Reason, one of the things that I've been asking, particularly, people before I was editor, I joined the staff in 93. I became editor in 2000. But so, you know, basically you, Bob, and Virginia, the people I've talked to, what was it like at Reason and within the larger libertarian movement when you, you know, started running the magazine? Have, you know, can you paint a picture of, you know, what was it like to be a libertarian at Reason in 1984?
Well, I'd start a little earlier than that, perhaps, because I kind of segued with each of my transitions at Reason. I got involved first in 1972, so 12 years earlier, when a professor of mine pointed me towards the magazine in the college bookstore. You probably didn't know that Reason was on any magazine racks at that time, but it was on the rack in the college bookstore at his school, and that's probably Cal State Bakersfield.
Which was? okay, very good. No,
right.
Look, we're spilling all the secrets. We're not, leaving nothing.
Now, no doubt it was on the book rack He was one of the editors at the time. And that was Tibor McCann, the late Tibor McCann. So he's one editor that you aren't going to be able to talk to live.
Yes. We luckily did have a couple of years ago at a Reason Weekend, our annual donor event, we had a really great panel with him, Manny, and Bob.
I think Virginia was in on that too. What's interesting is that I was completely apolitical. I was a college student during the Vietnam War era, but I was putting myself through college and was way too busy with that to be one of those students. So I didn't know when I landed with Reason, or at first discovering Reason, you know, unlike other students of that era, I didn't know what Berkeley was, or a lot of other students. I didn't know who Goldwater was. So Bob Poole came through with a lot of interaction with the Goldwater camp and so on. But when I encountered libertarian or classical liberal ideas this way, they just resonated with me. I think because of kind of an individualist, natural individualist kind of upbringing, I can point to things. But then,
what would some of those things be?
Personal responsibility. I was second oldest in a large family, and we had to take responsibility, and it was sort of in the DNA in our family that you were responsible for your own efforts. And I remember one time poking fun at my brother's bad report card and my mom saying, "That's his business and your business is your own report card." And and things like that. And so then when you encounter kind of the underpinnings of libertarian classical liberal thought, that kind of connects. So at least I've made up that story.
You are living a kind of libertarian life, meaning you're autonomous, you are self-reliant, you are, you know, making things happen for yourself. And you encounter Reason and you realize that there's a tradition and there are people out there who can explain, where that's coming from or why it's a
right.
good thing.
And although I had no backing in any political thought, I had just come of age to vote and or maybe it was a little earlier than that, but at any rate, that was the year that I
so you
that
got
was
to
the
vote
year that
the,
I first voted.
Yeah. Who did you vote for?
I don't remember what I remember, and this is before I ever read Reason, was that there was a, this yeah. being California, there was a ballot initiative in Bakersfield to municipalize the bus system. And I thought to myself, well, it seems to me that the people who use the bus system ought to pay for it, not the taxpayers.
So you were just a sitting duck.
I was a sitting duck, yeah.
Well, what was Reason talking about in 1972, or as you encountered? And Tibor McCann, of course, you ended up becoming married
right.
to Tibor.
Right, we actually connected right away. And so I was immediately pulled yeah. into this world and was in these circles mm-hmm. and hearing these ideas and hearing people talk about Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman mm-hmm. and so on, which was all completely new to me.
What was, you know, the obviously the Vietnam War and its foreign policy component, as well as the draft especially, were major issues for everybody. Abortion mm-hmm. politics were really heating up, particularly in California and New York in the run-up to Roe versus Wade. But what were some of the key issues? I mean, like, if you're a libertarian now, people would probably say, okay, I'm into privacy rights, foreign policy, like non-interventionism. Free speech, free trade, things like that. What were the kind of constellation of issues in 72 as you were entering the movement and Reason?
Well, you know, there were a lot of debates inside the movement: anarchism versus limited government, non-interventionist foreign policy versus fighting the commies, and so on. Mm-hmm. So those were the kind of the debates that I remember. But that's casting my mind really far back. But you know what was interesting about being pulled into this world immediately? Here I was without any background I was a college student, but I was putting myself through college and taking the courses I needed to take to graduate without any real picture of what I might do with that degree. Within months, I had a book review published in this magazine at the end of 1972. And about a year later, a paper that I had written for in the class that I had been taking with Tibor was actually published in the magazine, published verbatim, I notice, as I look at it now, which is kind of painful to see.
What was it about?
It was about, I had written the class that I was taking was Philosophical Foundations of Psychology or something like that. It was where mm-hmm. philosophy and psychology come together, and I was a double major in those two subjects, so it was mm-hmm. perfect for me. And I wrote a paper critiquing Thomas Szasz's The Myth of Mental Illness.
Oh, Myth.
Yeah.
So you show up and you're already taking.
I'm already taking on one of the.
one of the icons.
Although I don't think he was an icon at that point, but became right. one in spite of my criticizing mm-hmm. his thesis.
One of the things that I find kind of fascinating in talking with Bob as well as a few other people, it's interesting. I mean, now. The libertarian movement writ large, and I would say to a certain degree, Reason Magazine, is heavily, heavily identified with economics because of people like, you know, we our trinity is probably, you know, Hayek, Mises, and Friedman or something like that. But it's very economics focused. It's interesting to hear you say, you know, you were a philosophy and a psychology mm-hmm. major, double major. And it does seem like there were a lot of people who were into psychology and into philosophy at the early stages. Is that true? And then do you think that's kind of faded because economics is dominated, or is it still there in a vibrant strain in libertarian thought?
I'd say it's still there, but I'm influenced by having spent the last almost 30 years of my life now with the Institute for Humane Studies, which is deliberately mm-hmm. very interdisciplinary. Its founder was an mm-hmm. economist, but believed that to really understand what he called the science of a free society, we need to look across all the humane disciplines. So that's all the social sciences, all the humanities, as they're called in the academic world. So that's a pretty broad range. And that's one of the things that attracted me about IHS early on. And I think it's there in the movement. Reason has been strongly influenced, I think, by its roots in, I want to say, Bob Poole and public policy, which is not so much economic, but economics comes into it a lot because there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, the practical applications of the ideas. Right. But if you look at the very early issues of Reason, which came out of the Lanny Friedlander, who was a Randian, I don't know what his disciplinary background was, but there were a lot of philosophy pieces in the magazine, which was much smaller than it became in the 80s and beyond.
Was it exciting? I mean, on a day-to-day basis, did you feel like you were arguing the world and that, you know, these debates over, should we be minarchists or anarchists? Should we privatize the sidewalks or walk wherever we want and pay fines to people, you know, who's property we incursion on or something. Did you feel like you were at the start of something that, you know, and it is, and we'll talk about IHS in a bit as well. But I mean, you know, both with Reason Magazine, which is now, you know, just gone bananas in terms of the size and scope and the reach of things, the libertarian movement, which IHS is certainly a major part of. I mean, was it exciting paint a picture of, you know, what that felt like?
It was exciting, but I was like a kid in a candy shop. I was a complete bookworm when I was a kid. So being in this world of ideas in a serious way was just, and I was too young and too, didn't know enough to think, you know, am I on the ground floor of some shiny new thing, as opposed to, wow, this is really cool, and I'm here, I'm a part of it. In 1974, Tibor and I traveled in Europe. He had relatives there, and in the course of that travel, he interviewed Hayek for Reason. So, and this was before, it was a couple months before Hayek won the Nobel. So here I am, you know, I'm sitting there in Hayek's living room in Salzburg, Austria. And it was only later that I really realized what a big deal that was, you know, because I probably hadn't even read any Hayek at that point. You know, later I did. And yeah.
So you're like, hey, can we get out of here and do the Sound of Music tour?
No, because I actually was already, you know, very intrigued and involved. And and then, you know, to come back to your question about what it was like at Reason once I became editor and I said, well, I have to start earlier. Sometime shortly after that, Reason was still published as a labor of love by the three editors who had been involved in acquiring it from Lanny Friedlander. So Bob, Tibor, and Manny were putting it out while all having full-time jobs. And at some point, they asked me to be the book review editor. So this is probably around 76 or something, 75, I don't know. And it was a new position. They'd been running a book review or two every issue. But now here I was, again, this kid who didn't really know very much, corresponding with and soliciting from big names and sometimes lesser names, reviews of books by big names and sometimes lesser names. And you really get to, you know, be a part of something that way. And then by 1976, I was doing other freelance editing and picked up copy editing of articles for Reason. So then I actually joined Reason full time in 1978. And that was a major transition at Reason. It was entering its second decade, and the founders, or the, we would say the second founders after Lanny.
Right. Sure. Well, let's call them the founding editors.
The founding
editors
sure, set up the nonprofit Reason Foundation in 1978, mm-hmm. and the model there was actually Mother Jones, which is pretty cool.
Well, you know, let's face it, you know, lefties, they are usually very good with money, and they have a lot of it, it seems, you know, and their music and clothes are pretty good, too.
Well, so the idea was that this would give Reason, which was already asking subscribers to contribute on top of paying for their subscriptions, would mm-hmm. give Reason the opportunity to raise some money from foundations and to have the tax-deductible advantage for individual donors. So now in 1978, Reason had its first full-time staff, and that was Bob Poole and me, and as I like to say, a secretary who sometimes showed up. So it was...
Do we remember who that was? And please tell me it's Betsy DeVos or Jeff Sessions or somebody.
It was not somebody who was involved, and... I have no idea what her name was, but I can picture her. Yeah. It's really funny. But so it was still, it was still a scrappy magazine struggling on a budget. Mm-hmm.
Was it in Santa Barbara?
Yes, it was in Santa Barbara. Yes. Yeah.
So that's a pretty good place to be a scrappy magazine. You could do a lot worse.
It's like heaven in many ways, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I found out over time, Santa Barbara was kind of parochial. So, for example, you could not buy the New Yorker on the newsstand in Santa Barbara at that time.
What was it like trying, you know, I'm thinking about this because, you know, having talked to other editors where, and, you know, part of the focus, and actually Catherine Mangu Ward had the privilege or drew the short straw and interviewed me about my time editing Reason. And it was all about kind of, you know, the issues of simultaneity and of, you know, where you hear about something and you look it up online and you have the full thing in your inbox in 5 seconds. How did you...
That's so different.
What was it like? Yeah, what was it like to be in a magazine of ideas and that was talking about stuff that was gaining ground, you know, in 1975, I guess, I believe it was 75 when Reason interviewed outgoing or just Ronald Reagan had just left office as mm-hmm. governor of California. But, you know, you're engaging people like that, who was a very viable presidential candidate in 76, obviously won the Republican nomination in the election in 80. You know, you're hanging out with Hayek over here. I mean, how did you put your world together? Because this is also a time when long distance phone calls were an actual expense that people sweated.
Yeah,
much less trying to find magazines out of the New Yorker. Did you have to drive to the university or something?
No, you had to go to LA to get it on the newsstand. Now that changed over the time that I lived in Santa Barbara, but I remember that poignantly, as you know, for all who thought Santa Barbara was like this idyllic little heavenly place between the mountains and the ocean, which it is, it had its shortcomings. It's so hard to cast your mind back to what that world was like. There's a lot, you know, we corresponded with people. We wrote letters. We kept carbon copies of those letters. This was also pre-computer, so you were writing these things on typewriters. Yeah. And you telephoned. And I remember when the first fax machines came in, how very cool it was to be able to get something from, say, somebody in Washington, D.C. immediately.
Yeah. And by immediately, you mean like 5 minutes for a two-page letter or something. And to be like, I'm going to go out and, you know, raise a cow, kill a cow, cook a cow, eat a cow, digest a cow, and then hopefully the second page will have started.
Right. And during the so I joined Reason in 78, and then I became editor in 84. And during that decade of the 80s, technology changed so dramatically. So we went from people would send us a manuscript typed on paper. We would edit it by hand. Then we would send it by Greyhound, which was overnight delivery, to our typesetter, our libertarian typesetter in San Jose, who would send it back by Greyhound, and then we would proof it. Now, the typesetter note would have to re-enter all of that copy, retype, right? And so we'd proofread it, and there would inevitably be errors. It would get sent back as galleys, so long strips of type. And then if you wanted to, if you saw something you needed to correct, you tried your darndest to correct it only in that line and not make it change the whole paragraph. So it was a whole different world. And by the time I left, the magazine was produced. The physical production of the magazine had been completely transformed. It was now all done on computers. The first step of that was us all getting primitive desktop computers. And then we had layout capability in front of us on our computers. So we weren't sending stuff back and forth to the typesetter and to the printer. It didn't go to the printer until you're finally, okay, this page is ready to go.
Right.
And so on. So that was pretty cool to oversee it. And when I look back on my time at Reason, I think one of the big things I did was kind of professionalize the magazine. So we got much more rigorous about who we would invite to write for us and not just be dependent on what was coming in over the transom. We became good editors of people's material. Now the need for that, you know, there's a balance between how much you have to edit if somebody's already a good writer and they're just sending you stuff. But we continued to publish things from academics because that was a great source of material. And so sometimes our editing would be in effect translating that for a more general audience and so on.
What were to talk about the kind of themes and the content of the magazine while you were editing it? What are some of the stories that you're most proud of, or that you think were either a full realization of your vision of the magazine, or that were prescient and that you got there first and we're still trying to catch up, 30, 40 years later?
Well, some of them that I'm proud of, I was before I was editor, but I was very involved with, like the story we did on Love Canal in 1981 or 1982. That was probably the favorite thing that I worked on, partly because it was so dramatic, and we also realized that we'd better be darn right with that stuff. And so I cut my teeth on fact-checking on that.
Wow. And that was a story, this is something, having grown up, being in my 50s and having grown up in the Northeast especially, I'm very familiar with Love Canal. But that was a neighborhood in Niagara Falls, New York, that had apparently, had kind of toxic chemicals seeping through the ground, giving rise to what was at first seen as a rash of cancers and birth defects among residents there. And Reason's story showed that, it was more complicated than that, but actually the reason that neighborhood got built was basically because of the Board of Education of Niagara Falls had kind of pulled a fast one.
Yeah, and a journalist in the area named Michael Brown had written a book. And so that was out, and that was getting a lot of attention. And an author, a would-be author of an investigative article, came to us and said, I've been poking around, and Michael Brown doesn't seem to have the real story. Hooker Chemical was the company involved, although it had been bought recently by Occidental Petroleum. He gave us enough kind of indications of what he was onto that we decided to hire him to go for it. And he went to the area, to Niagara Falls, and went and looked in the archives in the city and so on, and found that the Board of Education had threatened eminent domain against Hooker to acquire this. And Hooker had said, no, you don't want this. And they did it anyway. And Hooker took Board of Education members out to the area where they had buried chemicals with clay all around it and clay on top, and drilled down so that they would know there's chemicals under there. and they insisted on a clause in the transfer of the property saying that you and anybody else who acquires this property, be aware that there are dangerous chemicals in here and you should never develop this property in any way that cuts into this. And over time, even though Hooker again showed up at the city council when they were considering pawning off part of it to a developer to say, no. And it was like, as Eric Zeus, the author, said in the article, it's as though they were sleepwalking.
Wow. And this, of course, played into in the 70s and 80s. The typical narrative was that American business and large corporations, and especially chemical corporations or oil companies, the only way they could turn a profit was by poisoning people, killing people, acting just absolutely horribly. So it was a real, I think a lot of us at Reason over the years, we look at that story or, you know, we kind of get shown that story as really one of the benchmark pieces that it, you know, it was based on really good reporting, really good journalism, and it flipped the conventional wisdom on its head.
Although you still see Love Canal referred to as a corporate disaster.
Well, it's, yes, know? Yes.
So, that's one of the frustrating things is, so you asked what am I proud of? What were the themes we took up? In many ways, the themes are still the themes. Some things have gone away, but in many ways, they're still the same things that Reason covers today and that are big issues today. Mm-hmm. Immigration, free trade, deregulation, drug prohibition. Mm-hmm. When I think about it, it's kind of depressing.
Although in some things, did you think that pot was going to be legal in many parts of the country?
We argued for it. Did we predict it? No, we were more humble than that, right. I guess.
I'm looking at a cover from August 1985 right now, and the cover is called Wireless Tapping, and it's a phone person, you know, so it's like, the surveillance state, et cetera.
And that was, that was a big article on how the NSA was preventing encrypted messaging. Yeah,
wow.
Exactly.
Isn't that amazing?
Exactly.
Yeah. This is what was your read of Ronald Reagan? And obviously your editorship would have overlapped with his second term, but also the collapse of the Berlin Wall. So this is, this is one of the great hinge moments of American history. How did you feel about Reagan in all of his particulars? And did you see, the end of the Cold War in sight
I think like a lot of people in the libertarian movement and paying attention to libertarian ideas, Reagan's election was celebrated, was welcomed, because here was somebody who was actually talking about restraining the size and scope of government. As time went on, he didn't make as good on it as we would have liked, even on something like on free trade, where I thought, he had the bully pulpit and he could have done so much more in support of free trade. And it took later presidents, including Democrat Bill Clinton, to actually make the kind of progress on free trade that we're now seeing undone.
Be totally eroded.
Yeah, be totally eroded.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I forgot my chain of thought.
Reagan was seen as a kind of a step in the right direction.
Absolutely. And I think, politics is what it is. I was always more interested in the ideas than in the political stuff. So, one of the things that happened with Reason's evolution is that it paid a lot of attention to Libertarian Party politics. And that was new. And basically, that kind of was the movement at that time. There weren't think tanks all over. Now, during the decade that I was at Reason, those started being founded and growing and so on. I've always been skeptical of how much we're going to be able. It's too soon.
Right.
I always used to say it's too soon to achieve a lot by politics. We have to change what people ask politicians to do, and too many people still want government to do a whole lot. But nevertheless, Reagan's the rhetoric that comes from a president and the aura and so on is really important. So Reagan was a step in the right direction.
Well, you know, one of the what's striking about Reason in the 80s, and particularly in the second half of the 80s, is that foreign policy matters.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I guess in a way, you know, obviously in 1984, and even to be honest, in 1989, it was not clear that the Berlin Wall was going to be torn down and that East Germany would disappear. And then 2 years later, the Soviet Union. What was the, within the libertarian movement, there seemed to be, there was a very robust debate about whether or not, you know, a kind of like in a, I don't want to say a neoconservative way, but a, you know, conservatives like Barry Goldwater, as well as, you know, Ronald Reagan, and a lot of libertarians were like, we need to meet the Soviet Union anywhere we can, a kind of Robert Heinlein Starship Troopers mm-hmm. mentality almost, that it was worth containing, pushing back, using military intervention when necessary. And then there was a radical, also a group that was much more at home with the kind of new left at the time, who
yeah.
would say that the American Colossus was, you know, just as bad as the Soviet Empire, maybe worse, and that we should be pulling out of every country. How did Reason kind of negotiate that tension within the movement?
Well, my recollection is that, as with other things, one of the virtues of Reason was that it drew on the multiple strands within the libertarian classical liberal world out there, community out there. And so Reason would sometimes, you know, publish a debate, say, between a non-interventionist and a no, really the Soviet Union and its empire is an existential threat to the U.S. and we need to do something about mm-hmm. it. We had internal debates. I tended to be more anti-interventionist than Bob was, mm-hmm. for example. So we would have knockdown debates about the one of the big questions was about what the government should do about the Contras, for example, because here was a client state of the Soviet Empire, not exactly in the U.S.'s backyard, but close, you know, and so. Now it's like, well, how bad a threat does it have to be before we're willing to swallow our desire not to have government get bigger and have them do something? And as I right. recall, Bob and I at one point wrote dueling editorials on the on the Nicaragua situation.
Well, and of course, Reagan was, you know, I mean, Iran-Contra happened on
yes.
his watch, but he was constantly talking about how, you know, these guys are going to build a highway into,
right.
I don't know, they were going to invade Texas or New Mexico or Arizona or California. And that was, yeah, that was a heat. And of course, a lot of Democrats were, you know, members of the Democratic Party and liberals were really hostile to the Contras and the Soviet Union
right.
as well.
Right.
What was the role of feminism, would you say, in kind of Reason at this time? Because that's also, you know, obviously you, you know, and I've always been, at first I was really surprised. And then as I became, you know, part of the kind of apostolic succession of people who have worked at Reason, really proud of the fact that, you know, there were women at the, you know, in the early days of the magazine and that, you know, we had a woman editor. We had a, you know, a lot of women in key mm-hmm. positions early on. What, you know, did libertarianism, you know, how does it intersect or how did it intersect with kind of 70s and 80s feminism?
You know, I think it's a credit to Bob and the other editors that my being a woman was just not an issue. It wasn't like a plus or a minus. And it was a natural transition. The Reason Foundation had been set up, was doing public policy. Bob had his policy interests and was torn in too many directions, and I was doing well. I'd progressed from assistant editor to managing editor, and, you know, mid-80s was just like, okay, Marty, take it and run with it. Be the editor. And there was no was no debate about it. Now, we covered some of the issues about feminism in the magazine, and usually we were pushing back against, because the tendency there, as in so many other areas, was for feminists to be asking government to solve their problems, right? Or what were perceived
why
as
women's
problems.
Wrong?
Why is that wrong?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you know, for particularly for women's issues, because this is an ongoing debate of where, you know, or I guess I there were particularly among the new left, it seemed, you know, there were people who wanted the government to do everything. And then there were people like, no, the government, particularly the federal government or a large state government, was the problem. And there were feminists who were like that, who wanted, you know, they didn't want to be protected. They wanted to be free to defend themselves. But what was a libertarian feminism like? And there were people who were writing for the magazine at that time. You know, where did they come from, and how did they fare at the magazine?
I'm not sure I have a good take on an answer to your question. They were out there in the firmament like other people, and basically arguing for independence, self-responsibility. I don't know that we didn't take up, say, the abortion issue from a feminist versus non-feminist perspective, for example. We took it up from more, let's have a reasoned argument about abortion. In fact, that's one of the early editorials I wrote, Reason on Abortion, saying that, look, we really have to get away from approaching this from both sides on an emotional basis and have reasoned argument about it, or we're still going to be dealing with this 40 years from now.
I assume, and I'm not sure why, but I think I have a good reason, and partly, but you're pro-choice. Is that correct?
I don't think it's that simple.
Okay.
I don't think it's that simple, because does that mean, mean it's up to a woman whether she can abort a fetus at 1 month, at 8 months, at I don't think there's a let me just leave it at that. I don't think it's as simple as many libertarians make it out to be.
But it's also not necessarily something for the either the state, or it's not a situation where simple majority should rule.
No, I don't think the question is if and when there's a human life involved, and unless you are a pure anarchist, we do ask government to get involved to protect human life.
Right. Do you have a particular time, and has it changed over the years, of when you would say that life exists in a way that the government should intervene to protect?
I don't have my own answer to that question.
Oh, wow. That's I'm sorry to force you to
we deal with the same question at the end of life, right?
Right.
And
yeah,
these are very, very difficult issues. I think that it's probably the case that the right answer will change as technology changes. So
right,
it used to be that if there's a much later period in pregnancy now, or much earlier period in pregnancy,
right,
where a fetus can be, an infant once born can be kept alive or with a reasonable probability.
Right.
Doesn't that change the picture? Shouldn't that change the picture?
Sure.
So I think these are the kinds of questions that need to be dealt with with reasoned thought, not with, I don't think religion can answer it in a pluralistic, multicultural society. It's just, and that was one of my arguments in that editorial way back.
How do you decide it then? Is it just the kind of uneasy truce or looking the other way? Or because it does, you know, and I guess this is part of what you're getting at is that, you know, it's especially these questions which are incredibly fraught with meaning and complexity that you want very clear lines, but you're kind of saying that there can't be, but then how do you live with that?
That's life, I guess. I think you probably, as in other areas, and we do this with end-of-life questions, we get experts there. And courts are, the arguments that happen in courts are particularly well-suited to settling difficult questions rationally. And those answers, again, can change over time as new challenges arise. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, to kind of key in on that idea of society having reasoned debates, and I'm sure that you, I take you to mean not that, you know, kind of not, maybe not appeals to emotion, but I mean, this is not, you're not calling for a world full of Vulcans who just, you know, put all the data into a computer and come up with the perfect answer or anything like that. Do you feel like we have gotten better or worse at that as a society, or has it kind of stayed the same?
Don't ask me in this era. It's one of my distresses about the, you know, the way the whole conversation has been degraded and, you know, in the last couple of years.
Yeah. What do you think is driving that degradation? Is it, I mean, are people dumber? Is it the technology available to people through things like social media and,
well,
you know, and other forms of...
Certainly social media has made a difference. But I think, you know, it occurred to me the other day that I think we should be careful about drawing conclusions too soon about the long-lasting impact of social media. Particularly the long, there's positive impact and negative impact. It's still relatively new. And, you know, we're human beings. We it takes us a while to sort through things and figure things out. And this is one where I think that the companies involved, individuals involved there's still a lot of things to sort out, and I think it'll happen. Mm-hmm. General, although it may sound from this conversation that I'm just a Debbie Downer, in general, I'm an optimist about life and about the human condition and the options that we have. But how things come out, and this is one of the difficult things about the classical liberal kind of take on the world. Unlike liberals and in many ways conservatives, we don't think we can predict what will happen if, you know, put all the right principles in place and this is what the world will look like. No. How things turn out depend on the choices of millions of individuals. That's a huge, a very important Hayekian insight. And so we can't predict how it's going to be. With some basic principles, we can say we think it's going to be better, and here's why. If people are left more free to run their own lives than if those decisions are turned over to experts or the majority and so on. But we can't paint a precise picture. And that's a drawback because people want to know.
Right. And yeah, no, and speaking of Hayek, I was just rereading a quote of his from 1967 where he, and I'm badly paraphrasing here, about how, the job is of every generation of libertarian or classical liberal thinkers to, you know, really make living in a free society an act of courage and exciting and to come up with a great libertarian utopian program. But you can't, right? Because it's the whole idea, the whole thought is no, you know, like you go build your own utopia.
But I think his key point there was that we inevitably have to keep looking at these things. It's not a relativist position. It's a epistemological humility about the world is going to change. You have different human beings involved, and so on. You're paraphrasing from his essay, "The Intellectuals and Socialism," which was published in the Chicago Law Review in 45, I think, or the late 40s. That's kind of the Bible of our work at the Institute for Humane Studies.
Well, and it is true, and this is one more reason to damn Hayek, is that, yeah, you don't reach escape velocity where you don't have to. I mean, every day you get up, you're recreating the world, and you're walking around the car and making sure the tires are okay and all the screws are in place.
And there's new challenges. In the 80s, the big debate in foreign policy was about ICBMs and, should we have them, should we not have them, and all of this. And, of course, Bob was very into this kind of engineering stuff and very interested in it, more interested in it than I was. But today, the challenge is, cyber security, and we never would have anticipated that. And now, as human beings and as societies, we have to deal with this new problem. We didn't have packaged lettuce and spinach in, and so salmonella that was easily transported from Arizona to West Virginia.
Salmonella wants to travel too, just like everybody else. So, I have been asked by Catherine Mangan Ward, and I hate to make it sound like this. I'm only asking you this because you were the first female editor. What about the Reason Cookbook? What's the story behind that?
Oh, Bob's wife, Lou Villetson, and I thought this was a brilliant idea to ask leading lights in the libertarian movement to submit recipes, their favorite recipes. It didn't have to be something they created, but could be, but their favorite recipes. And we would put this together in a book and sell it. And I convinced Andrea Rich at Laissez-Faire Books to buy 1,000. And by it was still the case that if you printed a lot more of something, the marginal cost of each one was, the average cost of each one was really, really low. And Andrea has told me that she dumped a whole bunch of them into the ocean. And I have apologized to her.
Do you remember any of the recipes? And were they all like, Ayn Rand's appetizers or something?
No, I mean,
that?
Barbara Brandon submitted an Ayn Rand recipe. I can't remember what it was. But Milton Friedman submitted stuffed cabbage made by Rose Director. Rose's. Was her name Rose? Rose's parents.
Her maiden name,
okay. No, by the parent of his wife.
I see. So by his grandma.
Carl Hess submitted some recipe for like peanut butter and chocolate chips and roll it into balls and eat it or something like that.
Eat it with the Black Panthers or something, right?
So it
Carl
was
Hess, who was the Goldwater speechwriter, became an anarchist of sorts. Talk about, you left Reason, you vacated the West Coast and moved to the East Coast. Why did you leave? And then talk about your job at the Institute for Humane Studies, where you were for years, and how that was or was not a continuation of your work at Reason.
I left Reason because I was exhausted. It was still a struggle to assemble the funds to pay editors and pay authors what we needed to pay and so on. And I was, by this point, a single parent and had a 10-year-old daughter and realized that I was, to make the magazine happen, I was spending way too much time on the magazine. My daughter actually asked, knowing I was going to be doing this, said, tell the sleepover story, Mom. So every Friday night, too, our drill was that after dinner, we would go to the office and she would bring her sleeping bag. And there was a ice cream or frozen yogurt place right across the street from the Reason was in L.A. by this point. And she would get to get her ice cream and then settle down and read and fall asleep. And I would work till 2 or 3 in the morning and then, you know, pick her up, carry her out to the car, carry her in. And this was a major way that I got caught up with peace and quiet on work. So
no, that sounds like a pretty, you know, pretty good deal for her too. I appreciate you. I appreciate your commitment because this would have been, I mean, basically your era and maybe a little bit before is when I started reading.
Okay.
So
there you go.
I'll have to see if I have old issues where I can kind of read through and realize that this is a, you know, this was from a sleepover night.
Right.
You said it in
right.
Japan.
So I was.
So you were exhausted.
So I was ready for a change. And partly because of the demands on me. And I had actually decided that I was going to go get a job in the real world. Forget this nonprofit stuff. And before I could actually do that, I had made up my mind, and it was late in the calendar year, and I realized that looking for a job around Thanksgiving or Christmas was not a good idea, so I was going to wait until after the first of the year. And not knowing that I had this intention, which I had not said to anybody, the Institute for Humane Studies recruited me to come. They were in growth mode and recruited me to come and as a vice president and start up some new programs. And I had gotten to know the people at IHS because they used to be out in Menlo Park, California. And, you know, there was kind of, in California, you kind of knew everybody who was involved in any way. And so I'd gotten to know the people at IHS. And then they had moved in 85, I guess a year before Reason moved to L.A., they had moved to Northern Virginia and affiliated with George Mason University. So I, after interviewing with them, I decided to take that job. And it was largely because I liked the people at IHS. I have to say in retrospect that I didn't really understand what IHS was all about, except that Leonard Liggio, now departed, long associated with IHS, was kind of my lifeline to ideas from time to time. I'd get this call from Leonard when I was at Reason, out of the blue, every 4 or 5 months. Was never clear why he was calling, but basically it was sharing some, you know, here's a new book you might be interested in. Here's, you know, just kind of keeping me and Reason plugged into the more academic, what was going on in the social sciences and the humanities. And IHS, I think, played an important role in that era in bringing new developments from that were relevant to our project from the academic world to a broader audience. And so this was kind of, you know, you're getting out a magazine every month and you're working the way I was. And after a while, you feel like you're divorced from the ideas themselves. You're just kind of doing the job, not in the sense of, you know, a carpenter just doing the job, but you're so busy with the day-to-day that you're not refreshing the intellectual roots at the bottom of it. So this was important to me. Anyway, the mission of IHS was attractive because it was continuing. I was always into the ideas and it was about the ideas. And so I took the job. And
IHS, the Institute for Humane Studies, which is at George Mason University, I have both taught at some seminars as well as been recipient of
you're an alum.
From IHS back in the days, yes. You know, I mean, the mission is partly to kind of identify people who are interested in libertarian or classical liberal ideas and particularly interested in careers like academics or in certain cases, journalism and whatnot, and, you know, help them, give them the kind of intellectual and financial and experiential support. Has it been successful? IHS was founded in
1961.
Like, yeah. So do you feel IHS you never achieve that end point. We're constantly rebuilding the wall or building it up every day. But has it gotten very far in what it's aiming to
yes.
do?
Yes. And I hope it's not just patting myself on the back. Just very briefly, as I kind of divide IHS's history, its first 20 years, as I mentioned earlier, was founded by a former economist. He had left Cornell University in the 50s because he was frustrated with hostility to the ideas of free enterprise and limited government in the academy. And he dreamed of starting something that would help change that, not just at Cornell, which he thought he might be able to do if he stayed there, but much more broadly. So its first 20 years, IHS really focused on building a network of intellectuals, mostly academics, but any intellectuals who showed any interest in the ideas. So again, this was pre-email and internet and so on. So it would be noticing that somebody had published something, putting them in touch by letter or phone with somebody else who was interested in those ideas and so on. And a few investments in particular scholars, they helped underwrite some of Murray Rothbard's works and so on. They subsidized the publication of Austrian economics books by a small publisher, kept those ideas alive. And then around 1980, IHS made a strategic shift to, the founder had died in the early 70s, made a strategic shift to not just finding the people that are out there, but deliberately identifying the next generation and trying to develop them. So during the 80s, had built a set of programs to help people into the academic world, brought me on board in 1989 to develop a parallel set of programs to help people into other careers and ideas. As you mentioned, journalism, public policy, right. Film and the arts. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, it's probably now about 7 or 8 years ago, IHS shut down, did creative destruction, as I like to say, on those programs that I came to IHS to build. Partly because the academic world, because IHS had been particularly successful in finding and developing future academics, and the need there was so great that the board and the management decided to focus IHS on that capability in particular. Mm. So we also started doing, whereas before we had, IHS had only invested in, made grants to and mentored and so on, graduate students, started extending our work out to faculty who are already out there in the trenches, whether or not they'd come through IHS programs. But if they kind of shared our general outlook on the world, you know, what can we do to help? And the current president, who succeeded me in 2016, is taking that work, comes from out of the academy herself. You notice that I only let women succeed me. No, just kidding. is taking that work, is doing even more in that direction. And of course, free speech has become a big issue on college campuses, and that's something that the Institute is very directly dealing with, working with faculty and administrators and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I was about to say it like it was a good thing. I mean, it's a real golden age, not just for free questions about free speech, but about intellectual freedom and academic freedom for faculty. Well, you know, this is, let me ask, you know, as a kind of final topic of conversation, you know, reason has been around for 50 years from, you know, 68 to now. You toiled in our trenches and then you went to IHS. You've been an integral major part of the libertarian movement for, you know, for decades now. Do you feel like we are gaining ground, or are we winning, or is this always a kind of rear guard action to just kind of keep these ideas alive until finally, you know, they actually become kind of hegemonic or dominant or you know, what I mean, you know, how are we doing?
How do
what's
I
our,
feel?
What's our 50
right?
year yeah. checkup? Yeah, yeah. What's our 50
depends
year
on
checkup?
Which side of the bed I got on. You know, some days it's just discouraging, but other days, and as I said, I'm generally an optimist. And you know, I knew you were going to pose this question to me, so I gave it some thought ahead of time. And libertarianism, classical liberalism, is definitely a part of the discourse now. It's sometimes misunderstood or it's painted with too broad a brush, but it's in the public square. Reason is one of the think magazines in a way that it was not in the decade that I was there. And Virginia has a lot to do with that. In retrospect, I left the magazine for my own personal reasons. But I think part of it was a feeling that it could use fresh blood. And Virginia was a much more pop.
I want to thank you for not saying fresh legs.
Because no, of course
as
not.
As a feminist, I would have had to have stopped you right there and ended this conversation.
She was a much more public person than I was. And the magazine needed it at that time, and it was ready for it. I like to feel like I got it ready for that. But Virginia took that and ran with it. It was really good for the magazine. Speaking of progress, one of the things I noticed, IHS has for many years done week-long summer seminars for college students, and we ask them to apply and to write a short essay so we can tell whether they're actually interested in this or just interested in going to visit some city, you know. And over the years, I saw this, you know, they'd cite the usual influences, you know, Milton Friedman, Hayek, sometimes Thoreau. They'd really go back in, you know, individualist history. At some, Ayn Rand, of course, always continued to be a huge influence. At some point, I started seeing Virginia Postrel's name show up as an influence. so her, the book that, which name has flown out of my head right now, but the first book she did, The Future and its Enemies, right? It got out there. And that's one of the ways you can measure the progress of these ideas, right? But you now see people like, you know, Virginia has a column with Bloomberg News. You see Megan McArdle all over the place and now has a column with the Washington Post. The Volokh conspiracy. In academia, there's now not just hundreds, but thousands who take core classical liberal principles seriously, and not just in economics. You have think tanks that didn't exist in the 70s. And, you know, look at the State Policy Network. They crow rightly that there's now a market-oriented think tank in all 50 states, and some have two. There's public interest law firms, student groups more recently. So there's now a thick infrastructure, and that's huge progress. But the progress in the political arena is where the rubber hits the road with policy, and we haven't seen it there. But as I said earlier, I think, you know, that just takes time, and it takes the stars aligning. It's going to take some more of the right people in politics. At a granular level versus the big picture, I think we can see progress. You know, IJ wins lots of cases for that open up liberty for individuals and in those specific industries, at least in a given city. So taxis get deregulated in, you know, such and such a city and so on. Lots of things have been deregulated, but then other things come along, and unfortunately, when these new problems come along, it's often the case that people's first resort, not their last resort, is more government.
That's right. Well, I'm thinking of what you said about social media. You know, when you see something new, you're shocked, and the first thing is, okay, how do we throw a bunch of nets on this and, you know, stun it, tranquilize it, and Yeah. And then it takes a while for things to kind of escape again and move on. I want to, you know, thank you so much, Marty, not just for killing an hour or so with me on this, but also for everything that you've done. One of the, you know, deeply moving aspects of being at Reason is to know, you know, get to meet and know the people who made things possible for you. And you certainly did that both at Reason and at the Institute for Humane Studies. So
thanks very much.
This has been a wonderful conversation.
Nick, and I'm looking forward to the celebration in November.
Oh, yes. We will continue to celebrate all year, maybe even into, who knows, if it works well, we can do it into 2019.
Great.
But thank you. We have been talking with Marty Zupan. She was the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine from 1984 to 1989. This is our 50th anniversary year, and we're celebrating our first 50 years, and we're looking forward to our next 50 years. This is the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, or anywhere you listen, and rate and review us wherever you find us. Thanks for listening.